Hello, everyone, and welcome to True Crime Boulevard. I'm your host, Bree. So this week I wanted to talk to you about the Chris Benoit double murder suicide of his family. This is his wife, Nancy Benoit, and his son, Daniel Benoit. So this episode has a content warning, like all of my episodes probably will. We're going to be talking about child murder, child death, abuse, domestic violence, domestic abuse. So if those things are hard for you, please take care of yourself, take care of your mental health, and I hope that you can join us in a future episode. With all that said, I'm going to go ahead and get started. This episode has a lot of information. I got a lot of my information from Dark Side of the Ring. It's a TV show on Vice, as well as from Chris Jericho's podcast, Talk is Jericho. This is a wrestling true crime case. I'm going to be doing a few of these. So if you're not into wrestling, sorry, you're going to be hearing about it a little bit. But this case rocked the wrestling world and affected how the wrestling companies dealt with their employees, how they dealt with getting injured and all kinds of stuff. That is the case that we're going to be talking about today. If any of the people that are listening are wrestling fans like myself, please do not be mad at me. This is like a super condensed version of like Chris's career. He had a 20 plus year career. This is like a condensed version, so don't get mad if I don't name all the titles and belts and companies he went to. With that said, we're going to go ahead and get into it. So, Chris Benoit, born May 27th, 1967, in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. He was also known as the Crippler, the Pegasus Kid, Wild Pegasus Kid, the Rabbit Wolverine. He had a bunch of nicknames while he was in the ring. He had a very happy childhood. His family said that nothing outrageous happened. He had a very like run-of-the-mill regular childhood. At about 12, his father took him to his first wrestling show in Canada. They went to see a show in Alberta for Stampede Wrestling, which at the time was like a really big company in Canada. He saw Dynamite Kid, and from then on he was just kind of obsessed with wrestling and Dynamite Kid. Dynamite Kid was his favorite. He idolized him, he mimicked him. Eventually, he used Dynamite Kid's signature move, the flying headbutt, as his finisher when he was in the ring years later. So a little bit about Chris and his wrestling career. He had a very illustrious and long wrestling career. He was known to be dedicated, a very, very hard worker. Like, he took no days off, even for things like going to see his family and spending time with his kids. In the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, he got married to his first wife. There's not a lot of information about his first wife. His first wife, his daughter, and his son, David and Megan. There's not a lot of information about them and their lives in Canada with Chris. Megan and her mom have completely left, like, the entertainment media, anything. Like, there's, like, nothing out there about them. They don't want to be in the media, so we'll respect that. So his career kind of took off in like the mid to late 80s. He started traveling. Again, at this point he had a wife and two children, but he started traveling. He traveled to Japan to travel with New Japan Pro Wrestling. And at that point he would meet a bunch of people that would become his best friends. I can't even name all the wrestlers that he was super, super close with, but a few of them were Chris Jericho, Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero, Perry Saturn, and so many more wrestlers that I could name that for whatever reason I'm truly going on a blank right now. But those were some of his really, really good friends that he made while in New Japan. Him and Eddie Guerrero were thick as thieves. Like, they did everything together. They spent all of their time together. They were extremely, extremely close. Throughout the years leading up to like 1995, Eddie and Chris would travel together to different companies. So they would go from New Japan to World Championship Wrestling, WCW, to ECW, Extreme Championship Wrestling, back to WCW, and eventually they would end at WWE. However, we're going to back it up just a little bit to their second stint at WCW, because that's where Chris meets Nancy. At this point, Nancy is working for WCW as a manager. She is working with her then husband, Kevin Sullivan. Kevin Sullivan was a booker, meaning that he made shows. He put people together. He pushed storylines along, or helped to like create storylines to like help them be pushed along on shows and in pay-per-views, especially pay-per-views, because those are the big pushes for storylines. That was his thing. He also was a wrestler. His wife was his manager, meaning that she went out with him. Sometimes she would talk on the mic for him. She would do little things outside of the ring. She was not really an in-ring competitor. She wasn't an official wrestler, like female wrestler. She mainly stayed out of the ring. I think there may be one or two instances where she actually got in the ring, but for the most part, she stayed out of the ring. She was not an in-ring competitor. So Kevin and Nancy are like a pair, and Kevin decides to make a storyline with Chris Benoit now that he's back, because Chris's name has blown up from him going to ECW and going back to New Japan. His career is blown up. And Kevin's like, okay, cool. I want to do a storyline with you. So we're going to make the storyline. And they come up with a storyline, and it changed the trajectory of everyone's life. Now, we're going to take a pause for just a second, and we're going to talk about Nancy for a little bit, because her story is very important in all of this, because sadly, from everything that happens later on in their life, her career is completely buried. Nobody talks about it, and it's truly a very sad story for her. I mean, this is a sad story overall, but for her, this is a very sad story, because her career was completely buried, covered. Nobody talks about it. So I want to give Nancy Benoit, Nancy Telefoni, don't quote me on that, it's Italian and I'm not good with Italian names. I want to give her just a moment to be able to really talk about her career and how we got here and how she really meets Chris. So Nancy Sullivan was born May 17th, 1964. She also had a pretty traditional upbringing. She got married kind of young. No one's really said exactly how old she was when she got married, but in the Dark Side of the Ring documentary, her sister Sandra was talking about her first marriage with her first husband and how she was actually pretty happy. Her husband was a huge fan of wrestling, and because he was such a big fan of wrestling and he would go to the shows, she just kind of tagged along with them, you know, whatever. Well, randomly, one night, according to Sandra, she just got picked out of the audience. They wanted her to model, kind of do little things, and from there her career really was able to take off. She started traveling with the company and was able to make a name for herself. She also meets Kevin Sullivan while doing this. She meets him in a photo shoot, and their relationship kind of starts to blossom. Her first marriage was ending, like they were starting to get really distant and they were getting a divorce. So her first marriage was ending. She meets Kevin Sullivan. They start dating, and by 1985, she was his manager for wrestling as well as his wife. Like, they had gotten married and were living this happy life, I guess, traveling, doing the wrestling thing. And it was going really good. People really believed what they were doing on TV. Obviously, if you watch wrestling, you know people have gimmicks and all that stuff. Their gimmick was like this satanist cult kind of thing, and people really tuned in. Like, they were like, oh shit, something's wrong with her. Like, no, nothing's wrong with her, she's fine. But she played into the storyline even outside of work. When people would walk up to her, she stayed in character, and people really thought that she was possessed, and they were like, something's wrong with that heifer. So all that to say, Nancy and Kevin end up at WCW. Chris ends up at WCW. Nancy has this amazing powerhouse career as a manager. She's well known. At this point, her name is Woman on WCW. Her career is going well. She's managing more than just Kevin. And the storyline comes in that she and Chris are going to have this affair. She's going to go manage Chris. I think the initial storyline was that she was going to go manage and help Chris. And then she had an affair with Chris. Like, that was the storyline that was beginning on screen. However, off screen, This was also starting to happen. This affair was starting to happen off screen. Chris was in the process of getting divorced from his wife and leaving his wife in that relationship. And Nancy was confiding in Chris that her relationship with Kevin had started to become very abusive, and he was hitting her, and it was verbal, and there were pictures of like bruises and marks on her. And Chris was getting very upset because he wanted to protect her, because he felt, how do you do this to your wife? Hindsight. As well as like other people that knew about it, they were worried about Nancy. And then it all kind of comes to a head at a pay-per-view called Bash at the Bay. And according to Sandra, who was sitting in the audience during the pay-per-view, she said that she watched this fight happen, and it went from a traditional pay-per-view, a traditional wrestling match that you would see, to like a full-out brawl on stage, on camera. And even after the bell finished ringing, like, they were still fighting. Like, they went backstage and the fight did not stop. Chris broke Kevin's eardrum. All kinds of crazy stuff was going on. They ended up having to come get Sandra, bring her to the back, and have her, like, try and break this up. But she couldn't. Like, she didn't know what to do. She didn't know where to go. She was looking for her sister. Her sister wasn't at the show. So she was like, do I go with Kevin, who is my brother-in-law? Do I go with Chris? I don't know what to do. I don't really know Chris. And eventually Chris got on the phone with Nancy, and he gave Sandra the phone, and Nancy was like, go with Chris. So Sandra was like, I listen to my big sister. So she went with Chris. And when she finally saw Nancy, she saw the black eyes and she saw some of the other marks. And from that moment on, for her, their relationship was done. Their relationship was over. And for Nancy, the relationship was over. She was now with Chris, and that was just kind of the end of it. Like, that was the end of Kevin and Nancy's marriage, following this storyline that happened on WCW. Now, the running joke in the wrestling world is that Kevin booked his own divorce, because he did. He booked the storyline. He was the one who created the storyline for himself and his wife. Kevin and Nancy got married in 1985, and by 1996 they were divorced, and Nancy was with Kevin. So in 11 years, everything kind of just trashed and died, like that relationship. As well as by the end of the 90s, Chris's relationship with like WCW, the company, was starting to dwindle. Like, it was going in a direction that Chris was not happy with. He felt that a lot of the wrestlers that were coming in were getting more time. You had people coming in from WWE who had really big names, and they were really big. Like, Chris is not a huge guy. Like, if you were to look at him, you would assume that he's like pretty big, but he's like five, he was like 5'11, 230 pounds. So, and a lot of these wrestlers are like 6'5, 310. You get what I'm saying? So, like, comparatively speaking, Chris was a small guy in the wrestling world, but he had this crazy work ethic. And because of his crazy work ethic and the way that he worked, you know, a lot of people could see around his height. But as a lot of wrestlers from WWE were coming in that had bigger names and bigger pools and all this stuff, he was starting to get frustrated because he wasn't being put in pay-per-views. He wasn't getting put in matches, or he was getting buried in matches, and his matches were like 2 to 3 minutes instead of everybody else who was getting like 20-minute matches. He made the decision in 2000, like late 1990s, early 2000s, to leave. Him, Eddie Guerrero, Dean Malenko, and Perry Saturn, as a group of men, as they had come into a lot of companies, the four of them also decided to leave WCW at the same time and go to WWE, all back to back to back. Like, they all, Eddie Guerrero, Chris Benoit, and Dean Malenko. I think Perry Saturn's in that video too. If you go on YouTube, you can see it. I believe it's January of 2000, they like kind of crash WWE. They come in through the audience and like walk in. And when they're doing that, of course, the audience is losing their mind because they're like, these are WCW guys. Why are they here? But that is how they came into WWE. They came in together. From there, they all had pretty successful careers. Eddie Guerrero probably had the most successful career out of all of them. But they all had amazing careers. However, a lot of people in the business, especially around that time, they were dealing with drugs, they were dealing with alcohol abuse, and addiction was a very hard thing for a lot of them. Eddie Guerrero, for example, is one of the people that dealt with a lot of drug and alcohol abuse. He was in a lot of pain from years of wrestling. There were surgeries that he wanted that he was not able to get. So he was in a lot of pain. He was taking a lot of pain meds to kind of cope with it, and then drinking on top of it. All of this, unfortunately, and led up to him being fired. His nephew, Chavo Guerrero, who was also a wrestler, came out and said that, you know, it got to a point where you couldn't hide it. Like, there was one point where, like, you could hide, you know, Eddie's kind of drunk, but, like, when you go on stage and you're just stumbling and slurring your words and you can't function, you can't hide it anymore. And that became very apparent. So Eddie ended up having to leave the company, go get sober, and basically start from the bottom and rebuild his career. He was able to do that. He was able to get sober. He got some healthy coping skills. He was able to heal his body the way that he needed to by taking that time off and getting that rest. And he was able to come back to the company later on. But in the beginning, a lot of wrestlers dealt with this. It's rumored that even Chris has dealt with abuse, like drug abuse and stuff in the past, but not nearly to the same extent. So just wanted to kind of give you guys that little information about, like, the drug abuse and the alcohol abuse that was happening in this early 2000 whirlwind of WWE, or just wrestling in general. Well, by 2000, it's just WWE because they bought out their own competition. That's for another podcast. So, one thing that Chris Jericho has always said about this time period of Chris Benoit in the wrestling business was that, or in Eddie as well, was just how they looked at the business. They looked at the business completely different. Everybody saw, like, a third of what they could see big picture. And so their careers really were able to blossom because they had that, I can see the big picture, I don't see just a little piece of it. Their careers were able to bloom because they could look at things in a different way. They could see things full circle, and it was great for them. So while Chris's wrestling career is thriving and doing amazing, his personal life is also thriving and doing amazing. He has his son Daniel with his wife Nancy in 2000. And then they also got married after that. Same year, they got married in 2000 as well. And they had a pretty happy marriage in the beginning. The first few years, it was pretty good. But somewhere in there, it started to get abusive. It started to get verbally abusive, physically abusive. And their relationship would never be the same. So in 2003, Nancy filed for divorce from Benoit, saying that their marriage was irreconcilably broken. I probably still said that wrong, but y'all know what I'm saying. But just, there was nothing anybody could do to salvage their relationship. And then she also said that there was cruel treatment. Like, that's what she was saying was happening, that he would break and throw furniture and all these other things. She also got a restraining order against him, and eventually she did drop the restraining order. She did stop the filing of the divorce proceedings. Her sister Sandra takes blame for a lot of that, because there was a time where there was an incident that happened between Chris and Nancy. Chris was taken out of the house and was staying in a hotel. Okay, I'm sorry if y'all hear chingling and barking in the background. I have two dogs and they will not leave me alone. So, yeah, Sandra had went to go check on her sister after this altercation. And Chris called and just really apologized. He really wanted to get back with his wife. Sandra was the one who ended up answering the phone, and initially Sandra was kind of like, I don't know about all that, but Chris just sounded very sincere. He was really like, I just want to apologize. I just want to talk to her. And Sandra ends up giving Nancy the phone, and Nancy ends up taking him back. He comes home, and from there, things started, I guess, to get better, but at the same time, not really, because there are wrestlers that lived in Fayetteville, Georgia, which is where they lived at the time, and they were like, nah, because cops were still getting called, and we were still hearing about it, and we were still seeing stuff, and we were hearing about arguments. So even after she dropped the divorce proceedings and she dropped the restraining order and all that stuff, the abuse was still happening. Ironic, right? Because he was fighting to get her out of an abusive relationship. But I'll get to my opinion at the end. So that was in 2003. And then in 2004, at WrestleMania 20, Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero win the two top major belts at the time, right? So Chris Benoit won the World Heavyweight Championship, and Eddie Guerrero won the WWE Championship, right? Those are the two belts they won. Those are like the two top belts in the WWE even now. They won, respectively, they both won the belts, right? So everybody is excited because they have had this very long career, and for the most part, they have been together. They've been working together. They've been traveling together. They've been going company to company together. And again, if you watch it, you can see this on YouTube. If you have Peacock, the subscription to Peacock or whatever, WWE has like linked up with them, so you can watch it on there. You can watch the whole pay-per-view on there if that's something you're into. But you can specifically see this moment from WrestleMania 20. It's at the very end where Chris wins and Eddie comes out from the back, because Eddie won his belt first. He comes out and he like gives Chris a hug, and he's holding Chris's hand up as, you know, he wins the title. And it's just like pure happiness from Chris, from Eddie, from the fans, from the other wrestlers who talked about it in like different interviews and documentaries and everything. Like, they've all talked about this moment as just like pure bliss and happiness. Chris's oldest son, David Benoit, says that he remembers that night like it was yesterday, and he wished that that night both of them had retired. However, that dream never came true. About a year and a half later, on November 13th, 2005, Eddie Guerrero was found dead in his hotel room by his nephew Chavo. He had had a heart attack and died in his hotel room. So I'm gonna give you a brief story on kind of how that happened, because this does affect Chris in like a very poignant way. So Chavo Guerrero got a call from the hotel that morning, and they were like, hey, we called your uncle this morning to give him his wake-up call, but he didn't answer, so if you could go down, you know, see if he'll answer for you. So there was already somebody at the door knocking, but Chavo goes down, he knocks on the door, they don't get a response, so somebody in the hotel has like the master key, they open the door, and when they go to open it, there's the latch is on the door. You know, you go to a hotel, you have the main lock, and then you have that latch to help keep the door closed. So that latch is on the door, and they're like, okay, so somebody's definitely in here, we need to be able to get in this room. So they break the latch off the door. Chavo goes in the room. You know, he's calling for his uncle, and he finds his uncle has passed out on the floor, and he's just shaking his uncle, you know, trying to get him to wake up, and his uncle passed away in his arms. So Chavo, of course, is just like, what am I supposed to do? He's trying to figure out what he, like, how to deal with this. He needs to call Eddie's wife, Vicky. He needs to tell WWE that Eddie died in the hotel. And he gets, while he's thinking about this, he gets a call from Chris Benoit. And Chris is like, hey, are we going to work out? What's going on? And Chris was staying in the same hotel, but Chris was in a different room, I believe on a different floor. But by the time all of this is going on, Chris was downstairs in the lobby waiting for Chavo and Eddie and a few other wrestlers to come down so they could go work out. And so he calls Chavo and he's like, hey, what's going on? Are you and Eddie ready? And Chavo, like, this realization takes over him. Like, I now have to tell Chris as well what just happened. So he tells Chris, hey, man, my uncle died last night. Like, he died this morning in the hotel. And Chris just breaks down. He's crying. He's screaming. Like, it's one of those cries that you never want to hear from a grown man. Like, it just breaks your heart. Like, it's absolutely crushing. And from that point on, Chris Benoit was no longer the same Chris Benoit that he used to be. WWE does a tribute episode to Eddie, and if you watch it, you can see Chris's reaction. And I say watch the whole episode because it's a beautiful episode, but specifically watch the 10 bell salute in the beginning, and just kind of watch Chris as much as you can. You can really see how this impacted him and how this, like, destroyed him. And then when he's doing his interview and saying his last words and giving his feelings about Eddie and everything, he, oh my goodness, I have watched that clip many times and I cry every time, because that is, you can feel the heartbreak and pain off of this man. Like, he breaks down to the point where, like, he's bent over sobbing, crying. Like, he tries to stand up to walk off camera and he can't. Like, he just breaks down crying because he is so crushed, and it was, like, soul crushing for him. Like, he did not know what to do with himself after that. And many wrestlers, even his wife, his sister-in-law Vicky, like, it's been stated that his wife has made many comments like, I don't know what to do anymore. Vicky Guerrero, that was Eddie's wife, like, she was crushed, and even she was like, I don't know how to help him because he's grieving in a very similar way that I am, as if he lost his spouse. Like, it was just so extreme that people did not know how to help Chris Benoit. Right after Eddie's funeral, he went overseas and wrestled in a show because that's all he knows how to do. His coping skills is wrestling. His coping skills is getting in the gym. His coping skills is getting thrown around a ring or throwing someone around a ring. Those are his coping skills. So he didn't have the skills he needed to get help, to get to the place where he could see the other side of life without Eddie. Like, he never was able to really get there. And for about the next year and a half, he was just in this very dark place. He would go to Eddie Guerrero's house and he would go in Eddie's room and he would, like, lay on Eddie's side of the bed and just cry and just sob and cry and sob and cry. Or he would go in the gym at Eddie's house and he would just sob and cry because he was just so depressed. It took Nancy and Sandra getting him a journal so that he could, like, write to Eddie for some semblance of some, like, kind of normalcy to come back. And even then, it really never came back because Chris just kept going deeper and deeper into this dark hole where he wasn't talking, he was isolating himself, he was coming increasingly paranoid, thinking that people were gonna follow him, people might try to hurt his children, hurt his wife. He was just at a place where he was in a very dark place in his mind. He became more abusive. People were starting to become more worried. Like, his wife would call Vicky Guerrero, because Vicky was working for WWE at the time, to be like, hey, have you seen Chris? And Nancy would be like, I haven't seen him at all day. I have no clue where he's at. And, you know, just trying to check up on him, but nobody could find him. Chris Jericho, who was really, really good friends with Chris Benoit, he said that when Eddie died, his relationship with Chris also died. Like, his friendship with Chris was just as nullified at that moment, because that's how deep of a hole he went into. He didn't talk to anybody, he didn't see anybody, he barely traveled with anybody. I think the only person he talked to was, like, the Guerreros. Like, he talked to Chavo every once in a while, but even then, like, it was sporadic and it wasn't consistent. So his life after Eddie died just turned into, like, this, like, crippling grief that he just, like, wasn't able to function. And truly the only time he was able to function and, like, be as close to normal as possible is when his kids were around. When his kids were around, he was a dad, or when he was wrestling. When he was wrestling, he was a wrestler. So on Saturday, June 23rd, 2007, so about almost 2 years, little shy of 2 years after Eddie's passed, Chavo was driving in Laredo, Texas, and he gets a call from Chris saying that him and Nancy have food poisoning and they were going to be late for the house show. Chavo did not get this phone call immediately. He heard the voicemail and he called Chris back to be like, hey, is everything okay? Chris was like, yeah, everything's fine. He reiterated, they just have food poisoning. I'm making sure they're okay. I'm going to be late to the house show. And then he said, like, he made a point to take a poignant pause, like a nice break, and say, Chavo, I love you. And Chavo was like, I love you too, man. And after that, they hung up the phone. That last little thing made Chavo concerned. He was like, is something wrong? So he calls Chris back. Chris doesn't answer the phone, so now he's a little worried, but Chris calls him back probably like 10 or so minutes later, and he was like, oh, my bad, bro. I was on the phone with the airlines. I'm trying to change my ticket. Yeah, everything's good. I'm fine. And he's like, are you sure? And he's like, yeah, everything's good. And he's like, okay. He never did arrive to that house show that night. He kept calling saying that they had food poisoning and the symptoms were getting worse. And so he was taken to the hospital, but he would be there tomorrow morning for the pay-per-view, in Houston. So on June 24th, Chavo got a text from Chris saying that the dogs were in the enclosed pool area and the back door is open. He also got the exact same text from Nancy's phone about even less than a minute later, not even quite a minute later. And then Chavo gets another text from Chris's phone that was just Chris's address in Georgia. And Chavo was like, yeah, bro, this makes no sense. I'm going to see you in the morning. I'll ask you about it when I see you at the airport. So he goes back to bed, doesn't think about it. Chris never shows up to his flight. Chavo was supposed to pick him up. He never shows up. And Chavo was like, okay. He called WWE and said that he would be there later. His wife and his son were still sick, but they were like on the other side of it, and he would just be getting in later that night or that afternoon. But again, he never shows up for this pay-per-view. Now, this pay-per-view was like a really big deal. It was going to push his career even further. He was going to get a new title and all this stuff. But he never showed up to the pay-per-view. So on Monday, June 25th, there was still no word from Chris, and people were starting to get worried. At this point, nobody has heard from Chris since the Sunday, like late morning before when Chris called the WWE. That's the last time anybody has heard from him. The last thing Chavo got was a text message, and it was very out of character for him. Like, it's just, everything was weird. Like I said in the beginning, he's a workhorse. He works all the time. The only job he has ever had is wrestling. He has never known another job. He's never gotten paid for doing nothing else. This man is a workhorse. So the fact that he's missed a house show and a pay-per-view, everybody is concerned. And nobody has heard from him since Sunday morning-ish. So everyone's like, has anyone heard? WWE officials are asking, has anyone heard from Chris? Chavo shows one of the officials the text messages. He shows him the text messages that he got from Chris. And old boy is like, dude, why didn't you show us this earlier? And he was like, I don't know. I didn't think about it. I figured I'd ask him about it when he got here. And so they're calling Chris again. There's no answer. So they call Fayetteville, Georgia police to have a welfare check done on Chris because nobody has seen him. He's missing pay-per-views, he's missing shows, and in the Dark Side of the Ring documentary, you actually hear the phone call that's made from WWE headquarters to the police station, and they're just like, this is very weird. They're very much confused, as was everybody. And a few hours later, they get a call saying that Chris, his wife, and his son Daniel were all dead in the home. Now, of course, immediately everyone goes into what happened. Was it carbon monoxide? Was it the food poisoning? Did something happen? Was there a fire? Like, nobody knows what happened. Nobody knows what's going on as to why everybody died. All they know is that they died. So Chris Jericho gets a phone call. He was driving and he had to like pull off the road because he just broke down. Like, he was just like, what the fuck just happened? Vicky Guerrero, and most of the wrestlers that were working for WWE at the time, they found out about it at the show, like that night, sitting outside of the arena, or not outside of the arena, outside of the ring. They found out that day. So Vicky finds out, she just breaks down because at this point she's lost her husband and his best friend. And like the last real tie she had to her husband was Chris, you know? Well, other than her kids, it was Chris. So she was completely heartbroken all over again. The police in Georgia had to call the police in Canada to let his first wife and his two children in Canada know what has just happened. And so everybody is just kind of rocked. WWE does this memorial episode to him because, you know, that's what they do for all their wrestlers. And he was just like, I mean, WWE was just like, you know, we don't know what happened, but we're going to do this dedication. And by the next day, by Tuesday, they were informed of everything that had happened. And from that moment on, Chris has never been spoken in WWE again. His name is banned in the WWE, and we will find out why in just a moment. And that was the end of Chris Benoit's career and legacy as WWE knows it. So, what happened on Monday, June 25th, 2007? Fayetteville, Georgia gets a phone call. They go do a welfare check. There's a neighbor who is standing outside, and she was trying to get somebody to open the door. She hears the dogs in the back. They see the dogs in the back. They ask her, hey, can you do something about them big old dogs? And she's like, yeah, I watch the house when they go out of town because he's a wrestler. And they're like, oh, okay, well, can you put the dogs away and go open the door? She's like, sure. So she goes on the property. She goes and puts the dogs away. She goes through the back door. She goes through the house. And does she come out the front door? No, no, of course not. Why the fuck would she do that? No, she decides that she's going to go through the house for a second to see if she can find anyone. And when she does that, she finds Daniel Benoit. She runs out the house screaming, goes to the police. He's dead. He's dead. She's freaking out at this point because she just seen this little boy that she's watched grow up on the floor dead. She's concerned. So the police go in the house. They have guns drawn. They're calling out, you know, police, somebody answer, anybody home, blah, blah, blah. They go in the first room and they see what the neighbor saw. Daniel Benoit's body was covered in a blanket with a body with a Bible next to his body. They continued looking through the house. They found Nancy upstairs wrapped in like a comforter, comforter or something, with a Bible next to her body. And then after searching basically the entire house, they found Chris downstairs in the gym. He had hung himself and committed suicide. And immediately when the police went through the house, they were like, okay, something bad has happened here. Something very, very bad has happened here. Because when they get upstairs to where Nancy is, because Nancy was on the second floor, I believe. When they get upstairs, they are like, this house is in complete disarray. Like, just completely disarray. What happened here? Like, even just walking into the house, it was messy. But upstairs, it was extremely messy. And that's where they found Nancy's body. So what people think happened on June 22nd, which is the Friday before the Monday they were found, on June 22nd, that Friday, they had a party at their house that has been confirmed, verified by family, friends. They had a party at their house on Friday. They had like a little barbecue backyard thing. And the party went fine. The barbecue went fine. Later that night, it appears that there was an argument of some sort, and Chris snaps. He had tied her up with duct tape of some kind, like tied her hands up. I don't know exactly how. I'm not a big fan of crime scene photos, and honestly, I can't find those crime scene photos. I'm gonna be completely honest with you. I cannot find them. I've looked. But her arms were tied down, and then she was strangled with like a phone cord, some kind of like phone cord, while he was pressing his knee into her back. So like knee to back, cord, the whole nine. It was bad. And then he wrapped her up in that comforter, whatever, and left a Bible next to her body. So that happened on Friday. On Saturday, June 23rd, he gave his son Daniel some Xanax to sedate him and make him drowsy, it appears, and then smothered him with a pillow. The reason why people think that he was, like, asleep and truly sedated is because there was no defensive marks. Like, he didn't try to fight his dad off. He smothered his son to death, and then did the same thing, covered his body, and laid a Bible next to his body. Then from there is when those calls to Chavo go out, where he's like, hey, they have food poisoning. And yeah, I'll be there, but I'll be there late. Because remember, the first phone call came Saturday, June 23rd, when the house show was supposed to happen. He never makes it to the house show. So they're like, okay, cool. So that's what he was doing on the 23rd. And then on the 24th, it was researched that he had Googled, like, how to quickly break your neck and, like, commit suicide. And then it appears that he drank, like, half a bottle of wine. And then he wrote a suicide note. And he hid it in a Bible that was later found by his family in Canada that got his worldly possessions after the fact. He made a call to WWE that morning and said, hey, my kid and my wife still have food poisoning and I will be late. I would be there later in the afternoon. They said, okay. He hung up the phone and then he proceeded to wrap a towel around his neck. He used a lap pull down machine. I don't know machines like that, y'all. I don't work out. I'm fat. Sorry. He took one of those machines that you like grab and you pull it down. He took the bar off of it, so it was just the cord. He wrapped the cord around his neck. He set the weight to 250 plus pounds and then released the weight, essentially hanging himself in his gym and immediately snapping his neck. Of course, there were autopsies that were done. Nancy had alcohol in her system, which many people equate to the Friday night where they had been drinking, because there was alcohol, there was beer and all kinds of stuff. They even went in the backyard and you could still see, like, beer cans and stuff. Like, people had been drinking. There was very high levels of alcohol, but they weren't sure if that was from her drinking Friday night or from the decay from her body, because that could mess with alcohol levels in your body, because chemicals, your body breaks down, decay, all that good stuff, and you have naturally a little bit of alcohol in your body, right? So that was Nancy's autopsy. Daniel's autopsy just shows that he was drugged, and then Chris's autopsy shows that he had high levels of testosterone and I believe alcohol in his system when he died. I'm pretty sure there was alcohol. I'd mainly talk about the testosterone because that's what drives me up a freaking wall, because everyone in wrestling is like, there's no way that he could have done that. But it's like, dude, it's there. The testosterone is there. It's not like it's not there. We can very, very clearly see that the testosterone is in his levels. But yeah, if I'm not mistaken, there was alcohol as well in his body from the Friday before. And then also, like, it appears that he drunk like half a bottle of wine. So I'm pretty sure there's alcohol in his system. But again, when I read his autopsy, I focus more on the testosterone aspect because of my next point, steroids. Many people believe that he was on steroids. I'm one of those people that think he was on steroids because he was huge. If you go back and look at pictures of him, this dude is humongous. Like, he's not a tiny dude. He's a big guy for 5'11". 225 pounds. Me and him are like the same size, like height wise me and him are like the same height. And though he was smaller than me, like weight wise the dude is humongous. Like, he was probably bigger than me because of all of his muscle mass. So I'm not shocked that he was on steroids at all. A lot of wrestlers were on steroids back then. Now, a lot of them will also tell you that because of Eddie's passing and the drug abuse, and knowing that the reason Eddie died was from like a heart attack, but the heart attack was from his heart being damaged from the drugs that he did while he was wrestling, WWE got very, very strict on their wellness policies, and they got very strict about drug testing and all of these lovely, lovely, lovely things. However, it has been stated by a lot of wrestlers, there was like a huge lawsuit that like people knew how to get around the drug test. Now, if you ask Chris Jericho, that's complete bullshit. There's no way he could have done it. WWE super strict. You can't even take strong aspirin without a doctor's note. And all of that might be true. However, there's one too many wrestlers saying that you can get around this fact. You can get around the fact that, you know, they do drug tests or whatever. And the fact that the testosterone was there, it's there. You know what I'm saying? Like, the high levels were there. He was found a day later. So, yeah, I think testosterone and steroids probably played a really big factor in the way that he was acting. It probably affected his paranoia and his, like, it affected his mind probably more than anything. But specifically when it comes to, like, this, it's probably, like, the paranoia, the weird behavior that he was having probably stemmed from the steroids. And I wouldn't be shocked if he was dealing with forms of roid rage. You're hearing about him having these, like, episodes where he would just break furniture and spaz out on Nancy, where he went from being this very, very calm guy. There is no statements anywhere from anybody from his first wife that he was ever abusive. The relationship just ran its course. Whereas with Nancy, you hear that he became abusive. He turned into this person that nobody knew. So when you hear that, you definitely can see how steroids would have played a part in his actions and the way that he was behaving. As well as trauma to the brain. A lot of wrestlers take a lot of trauma to the brain. They like to take headshots, chair shots to the brain, to the head. It's not a good look, friends. Bad idea. And once Chris had his autopsy, his family wanted more people to, like, look. And there was a doctor who used to be a wrestler. He came and went to his dad and was like, hey, I want to look at his brain. I want to specifically autopsy his brain to see if he has any signs of chronic traumatic encephalopathy or CTE. He did. He had severe CTE. A lot of wrestlers and a lot of football players get CTE. You get CTE from tackling people and running your freaking helmet into someone's stomach. You hit your head on the top of your helmet and your brain might rattle around in there, okay? So that was also something that it appears that he was dealing with. Now, the catch about CTE is that you really can't find out about it until you're dead. A lot of the wrestlers heard about the CTE that Chris was dealing with, and for them it's like, I mean, well, how much of it do I deal with? How much of it do I have? Because I took those chair shots. I took those really bad nasty falls or those punches to the head with a blade and did all that stuff. Like, I took those hard punches. I did all those things. So that's a very valid question. How many of these wrestlers, especially from like the 70s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s, are dealing with CTE from the things that they were doing to their bodies while wrestling? Now, part of the reason that Chris Benoit may have had CTE was because of his finisher, the flying headbutt. Now, he is not the first one, nor the second person to say, don't do this move. So why he did it, I don't know. But Harley Race, which is a older wrestler, he came out because he was like one of the first people to do the flying headbutt, and he was like, don't do this, it fucks up your back, it's not worth it. You, like, your life, like, your, the way that you can live your life, being comfortable, being pain-free, like, that goes out the window. Like, it's severely diminished from doing this move. So Harley Race was like, don't do this. He told this to Dynamite Kid. Dynamite Kid does the move anyway. Ends up in a wheelchair. Dynamite Kid worked for Stampede Wrestling. Benoit started his career at Stampede Wrestling. Dynamite Kid went to Benoit and said, hey, dude, do not do this move. It will fuck up your back. It will fuck up your neck. You will be in a wheelchair. You will be wheelchair bound for the rest of your life. Do not do this move. What does Chris do? He does the move anyway. So, as we can see, if I'm not mistaken, the flying headbutt is now like a banned move. Like, nobody's allowed to do it. And sadly, Chris was the cautionary tale for that move. He was a cautionary tale for a lot of things when it comes to concussion and head traumas, because when they did autopsy his brain and they looked at it and they saw all of like the callous pockets and how just atrophied his brain was, they were like, it was like looking at an 80-year-old man with Alzheimer's, like the brain's physical comparison, like the way that it physically looked like an 80-year-old man with Alzheimer's. Now, it took a few years for people to really understand what that meant, because if you ask Sandra, especially like right after it happened, and even a few years, like even up to like, I want to say like 2015, 2016, when she did the interview on Talk is Jericho, she was like, that's bull. He was fine. He was upright and walking. He was completely normal. That may be true. However, Chris had severe damage to his brain. And that is proven in these autopsies. He had severe damage to his brain. That does not mean that he wouldn't have been able to stand up and walk right and do these things. He probably could. It probably affected more of like his emotional ability to cope with things and deal with stuff, because your chair shots are getting taken in the front of your forehead, and that's kind of close to where your emotional standpoint is in your brain. So if you're constantly getting hit over in the front and over the top of your head, it's gonna affect different parts. So that definitely explains a lot of things, like when it comes to like what he could have been going through on top of the steroids, and then on top of the fact that this man was just severely depressed and did not have the coping skills to get better. Like at the end of the day, when it comes to certain things, like he did not have the coping skills to get better. And a lot of wrestlers have said this, and I agree with it. Chris's fate was sealed the moment Eddie died. Like, the moment Eddie died, Chris's fate was sealed. Because he never got out of that depression, and it didn't appear to anybody around him that he was even really trying to. It was almost like he was trying to find a way to get back to Eddie, and he was done with this world. And he says that in his letter, like, he's done with this world, and he's leaving. So it became a very dark place, and because of that, he made an egregious error of judgment that almost took down the wrestling business, something that he loved. It destroyed his legacy, it destroyed his name, I'm sure something he never wanted. And, you know, I think now if Chris Benoit were alive to be able to see what he'd done, you know, he would have made different choices. Like if Chris Benoit could have had a time machine to go 10 years in the future, he would have never done this, because it almost destroyed everything. His son and his daughter were horribly teased and tormented growing up, because of course people are like, that was your dad? Oh, so you're just going to be, you know, just like him and all that stuff. So it's taken years for them to both be able to have a regular life. His daughter now has a regular life. His ex-wife has a regular life. She lives her life freely in Canada, if I'm not mistaken. David said his mom got remarried, so she's happy. His sister is thriving and living her life. David is the only one who really comes out and talks to the media, and he's happy. He wants to be a wrestler. His dad is still his hero. Is he angry at his dad for what he did? Yes, absolutely. But does he love his father? Of course, because that, at the end of the day, is his dad. If it wasn't for his dad, he would have never found wrestling, in his opinion. So, you know, he still loves wrestling. He wants to be a wrestler. And I hope for him, he gets the chance to do that. I hope that he gets to make a name for himself. I know it's going to be hard, because he is a spitting image of his dad. Like, you know, we say some people, you know, get plucked out of their parents' nutsack. Yeah, like, he's one of those kids. He looks exactly like his dad. But he has a lot of good support behind him. Chris Jericho, Nancy, Sandra Teflone, Nancy's sister, is there. She still supports him. He still calls her, you know, his auntie. So they still have a good relationship. He has Chavo Guerrero. He has a lot of people that are there to support him. So I'm glad that there's something good coming out of this. You know, David did not just kind of fall into abyss, you know, he didn't just kind of disappear. He was able to have a good life. He has a good job. Like, he's living a good life. So yeah. Thank you guys for coming back to another episode. I can't wait to talk to you guys again next week. I'm definitely going to try and keep the next one a little bit shorter. This is a long-ass episode, I feel. I think it's almost an hour long, so don't get too used to this. I'm gonna try and shorten it up. I can get long-winded, so sorry. But I will be back next week. I post on Thursdays, wherever you get your podcasts. So please like, comment, rate, follow, all that jazz. And if you'd like to reach out to me, you can find me on Instagram at True Crime Boulevard. That's TRUECRIMEBLVD. Or you can email me at truecrimeboulevard@gmail.com, spelled the same way, TRUECRIMEBLVD@gmail.com. If you want to send me any suggestions of cases, give me any tips, or if you just want to say, hey, I love all of that. Thank you so much for joining me. And until next time, it's Bree, and I'll see you guys next week.